pursue at this point, except that I will say a few things of a very general nature which are all well known. But before we proceed with Savitri's Yoga, a few general remarks about Ashwapati's and Savitri's Yoga may be in order. Ashwapati, basically, as you know, is a scientist of yoga. He is an explorer. He has a, just as a scientist has no personal passion in his seeking of truth, he just wants to find out truth and meticulously goes doing it and records facts and analyzes facts, draws conclusions. Sri Aurobindo's attitude towards yoga was exactly the same. He was primarily an explorer, a witness, and you don't see anywhere in Sri Aurobindo's or Ashwapati's yoga a personal passion. It was all impersonal. Sri Aurobindo or Ashwapati were doing yoga in a very impersonal way. And that is why Sri Aurobindo was able to keep a record of his yoga. As you know, two volumes have now come out in the latest edition of Sri Aurobindo's works, which are called A Record of Yoga, which shows, just as a scientist keeps a logbook or an explorer keeps a daily diary, which is also his logbook. Today we crossed such a thing, these were my experiences, these were the things we needed, these were the things we had, these were the things we didn't have. So, like a meticulous scientist, Sri Aurobindo records his daily experiences. He also records where he thinks he has made a progress, in what respect, how much progress, and in what parts he doesn't see a progress, in what other parts he feels no progress but a regress. All these, like a meticulous scientist, Sri Aurobindo has recorded. In fact, Sri Aurobindo's attitude towards yoga was as impersonal, as objective, as that of a scientist in his discipline. In fact, a French scientist who came to the ashram in the 30s has left this on record, that he didn't find anybody who had this kind of an impersonal, precise, scientific attitude towards yoga. So that's what characterizes Ashwapati's yoga as well. One by one, he climbs various worlds, very objectively looks at the nice things about that world, the things which are lacking in that world, or things which make that world not entirely desirable, and he goes up. Sometimes he comes across worlds of dark forces, evil, etc. Those also he goes through without at all being affected by them. He also goes through various kinds of paradises, vital richness, vital fulfillment. There also he is never doesn't feel like even taking a second look at it. He just sees what it is, records what he has experienced, and then goes on. This is his general attitude, and as it is generally being said, Ashwapati represents the Vedic Agni. Agni is aspiration. As long as the Agni keeps burning up in the front, the fire of Yajna also keeps burning. So Ashwapati is this burning aspiration, and as you can see, he's always burning, he's always going up, up, up like that. Totally impersonal, totally objective, totally a witness. Sri Aurobindo's own yoga, Ashwapati's yoga, Sri Aurobindo says, can be divided into three parts, three phases. In one of his letters he has said this. Phase one is Ashwapati's own psycho-spiritual transformation, which he has described in cantos 3 and 5 of book 1. 4 is not a description of the yoga, but 4 is the knowledge that yoga brings you. There are two kinds of knowledge. One is information you gather from books and store in your mind. Another kind of knowledge is knowledge which is not found in any books, but you get as a direct experience, either intuitive experience or a descent of knowledge into you. And one of the central processes of Sri Aurobindo's yoga is make this descent possible. Whether it is Sri Aurobindo's yoga or the mother's yoga, they take their stand in a particular poise of consciousness, open themselves to the higher forces, and always are in a kind of expectant mood of recipients, and sometimes there is this powerful descent of knowledge, of power, of delight, of various kinds of things. This is, Sri Aurobindo himself in one of his letters says, this is the central process of my yoga. You don't struggle, there is no wrestler struggle here, but you keep your patra, you keep your consciousness open for this descent. Now keeping the patra open is not very easy. That is where you require the discipline of aspiration, rejection and surrender. And as I told you, not much is being said anywhere about rejection except in the book The Mother. But rejection is the key to complete surrender. You cannot, many people have aspiration. But when aspiration doesn't remain pure, aspiration doesn't remain undimmed if it is not supported by rejection. So rejection has always to be there to make aspiration pure, aspiration continuous, aspiration powerful. Rejection is needed because we have to reject so that space is made, room is made in our consciousness for new things. This is the whole secret of yoga. Most people are lethargic about rejection. They are very keen on aspiration. But they don't realize, as the rejection, you don't take it up very seriously, your aspiration gradually becomes solid, colored, and loses its purity. And that's why you see people all the time talking about the mother, and very often when you listen to them closely, they're only talking about themselves in the name of the mother. This kind of thing goes on. I'm not saying, you know, that I am free from it or X is particularly open to it. This is a trap in which we fall. And that is why rejection is a very, very important part of our yoga. Only when rejection and aspiration, to the extent they become complete, to the extent they become powerful, surrender also becomes powerful. Now this is something that you find common in the yoga of Ashwapati and also in the yoga of Savitri. One could write a whole thesis about this, aspiration, rejection and surrender in the yoga of Savitri and Ashwapati. If there are young PhD candidates, etc., you could take this up and do something very useful in that direction. But this has to be done carefully and this has not yet been done. Now, in Ashwapati's yoga, as you see, he has said there are three stages. The first stage describes his psycho-spiritual transformation. Now the question is, Sri Aurobindo's yoga has three transformations make it complete. Psychological transformation, spiritual transformation and supramental transformation. Now it is very clear that Ashwapati doesn't undergo supramental transformation. Now, this is where all comparisons are dangerous. Because Ashwapati didn't go supramental transformation, it would be wrong for us to conclude that Sri Aurobindo also had not gone supramental transformation, which is not true. Of course, Sri Aurobindo hadn't gone the complete transformation of his physical consciousness, etc. But as you know, from 1920-25 onwards, the supramental was descending into his body, and people like Ambubai Purani, etc., when they came to see him after a gap of about 18 years, was quite surprised to look see him, because Sri Aurobindo used to be in his Baroda days a typical Bengali. How is a Bengali, fair or what? I mean, some Bengalis are super fair, but the general complexion of Bengalis is what we would call shamal, right? Sri Aurobindo had that color. But Ambubai Purani came back 18 years later and found a golden luster on his face. He said, "Sir, what has happened to you?" And Sri Aurobindo quietly replied, "What has happened to you?" Because by those 18 years, Ambubai also has grown a beard. So like that, and it was because the physical was descending into his vital that these changes were coming into him. Now, this is where one has to be very careful and not, therefore, equate Ashwapati with Sri Aurobindo all through. Okay? But in Ashwapati, we are now talking about Ashwapati, there was no supramental transformation because Ashwapati only experiences, as I said, read out yesterday, the supramental experience in the transcendental. Because the supramental by that time had not come down. And the bringing down of the supramental is the Divine Mother's job, and that is why he wants an incarnation of the Divine Mother. That's why Savitri is born, and Savitri has to bring it down. If when Savitri brings it down, if Ashwapati lived a long, long life, he probably would be able to participate in it. Sri Aurobindo hasn't told us how long Ashwapati lived. In fact, Ashwapati is a very, very quiet person. I don't know whether many of you have noticed, in the whole of this epic, Ashwapati opens his mouth only 3 times. Savitri speaks all the time. Ashwapati only 3 times in the whole of this epic. The first time he speaks is to the Supreme Divine Mother in Book 3, Canto 4. Right? The second time he speaks is when he advises Savitri to go out and seek a companion for her life, the second time. The third time he speaks is when Narada is visiting them and Savitri's future is being discussed, and Narada is talking about fate, etc. Ashwapati raises a query. So these are the only 3 times Ashwapati spoke. This is very characteristic of Sri Aurobindo, no doubt. Because people like Narada, etc., who lived with him, said Sri Aurobindo was extremely economical of speech. No matter how inconvenient the environment was, he never complained about it. He never said, it is too hot today for me to work on the Life Divine. He didn't say that my bhaktas have put too much sugar in this sweet. This also used to happen. Some lady had sent some prasad or something for Sri Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo just touched it and sent it back, and she was in tears. My lord hasn't taken what I had cooked for him. Wasn't it sweet? Sri Aurobindo has written in reply, it was sweet, but too sweet. So he had all these things to put up with. He never complained, and even when he wanted a sip of water, it was the most indirect passive construction, passive voice. You know, there is a passive construction in Indian languages or in English that he used. He never said, please bring me a glass of water. That would be very direct. He never imposed himself on anybody. That was Sri Aurobindo, and that was also Ashwapati. He spoke very little. As I said, in the entire epic, he speaks 3 times. On the other hand, Savitri's yoga is different. Savitri takes the path of the psychic right from day one. And from the psychic, as it were, she cuts across into the supramental. Towards the end, Sri Aurobindo has recommended that this path is better for all of us. He says, I and mother have tried all different ways, but we find this is the easiest path. So the mother's path he recommends for everybody. But finding the psychic is like being in Shavasana. You know Shavasana? Easiest of asanas, you don't have to do anything. In all the other asanas, you have to balance yourself on the head, that is Shirshasana. Or you have to raise this part of the body, etc., etc. Bend this way, that way, Shavasana. No bending, no raising, just lie down. Then don't go to sleep. That is Shavasana. Very, very, very difficult. One has really go over each part of one's body. It's only when you do Shavasana you realize how many parts of the body you have. Normally we are not even aware. And slowly try to relax each part so that the tension goes away. Some of the Shavasana teachers take you through this discipline, and their voice itself is like a lullaby, a kind of sleep. So, this is just as Shavasana is difficult, bringing psychic to the front is equally difficult. Bringing psychic to the front, there is only an easy solution. Easy way, easiest way possible. What is it? Don't be selfish. Give rather than take. Is it easy? Giving rather than taking. It's extremely difficult. So, this is as difficult as the tapasya. Some people go the way of tapasya, which is very difficult. This is the way of the psychic. Bring it to the front, let it aspire. And the psychic, as you know, is like the sunflower, which is constantly turned towards the sun. But one has to be eternally vigilant, constantly guard oneself. And every action of egoism, every action of self-aggrandizement in any way. We don't aggrandize ourselves only physically. We also aggrandize ourselves. We also assert ourselves emotionally, intellectually, mentally. All these things are a bar. And as you do this, people may clap, may admire you for all your brilliance and all your strength and power. But what you find, your psyche gets more and more and more clouded. So, there is no way, there is no way of cheating the psychic. So, if that comes to the front, from there it's all very easy. And for this, no great sadhana is necessary. You don't have to flux your muscles, what you call uttabhais, and then dand, malkamb, all these things are not necessary. But it's very, very difficult. Quietly, in peace, give yourself, without holding anything back, give yourself not to the divine, give yourself to the divine is easy. If the divine were to come to me every morning and say, give yourself, I will give it to him. But he doesn't come that way. He comes to me through my cantankerous neighbors, through my co-workers in office, through the guy in the idli vada shop who makes me wait endlessly because I don't speak Tamil, and caters to other people's orders. God comes to me in all these forms. And giving to such a God is very, very difficult. See, God, I knew God had come, I won't keep anything for myself, I'll give everything. So as a result, what happens in many people's sadhana, their relationship with the world become more and more sour. They can't get along with more people. I would say your ability to get along with more people is a positive sign of your spiritual progress. I'm not saying you must be a Rotarian or a Lions Club man and make friends everywhere and shake hands with everybody. And you don't have to go and do it. But does other people's presence bother you? If it bothers you, there is something wrong. So, this psychic discipline that the mother was talking about and the path which the mother took up, very, very difficult. Looks very simple but easy, but they are very difficult. And so, this is the path of the psychic. And she also goes through a yoga. We will see what the yoga Savitri goes through. It's also described here. But she doesn't have the impersonality, she doesn't have the total witness attitude of Ashwapati. She can't, because death to her is not an impersonal problem, it's a personal problem to her. Death has knocked at the gate of her door of her bedroom. If tragedy comes and knocks at the doors of your bedroom, it can't be an impersonal problem, it has to be a personal problem. So the way Savitri pursues her goal, there is a lot of passion involved in it. There is a lot of strength, drive involved in it. That's one major difference between Ashwapati's yoga and Savitri's yoga. And it has to be that way because Ashwapati represents the Purusha, the static Purusha. And Savitri represents the dynamic Prakriti. She's more dynamic. So Savitri's yoga has to be more dynamic. So Savitri's yoga is more dynamic. Ashwapati's is more in equipoise, in balance and witness and so on. Just as I said, Ashwapati's yoga is in three parts, and part one, as I said, is cantos 3 and 5 of book 1, his psycho-spiritual transformation. Part two, his exploration of all the worlds, right from the gross physical to the subtle physical, to the various vital worlds, all the mental worlds, all the spiritual worlds, through all this Ashwapati goes systematically. Savitri also goes through this exploration, but this is done very quickly. What Ashwapati does over about 200 pages, Savitri achieves in 3 pages. Because Sri Aurobindo doesn't have to repeat all this again in Savitri's case, but Savitri does go through the exploration of all these worlds. Then, Savitri's yoga does not involve only psychic and spiritual transformation, it also includes supramental transformation, because that was Savitri's primary job. Now, it is not very clear if you read all critical works, expositions of Savitri done by several people, where exactly is this described by Sri Aurobindo? Where? This spiritual transformation or supramental transformation or descent of supramental in Savitri, where is it described? We almost assume that it must be somewhere, but nobody has put a finger to it and said this is where it is, except in book 10, canto 4, when finally she is about to defeat, conquer the god of death. I have slightly different ideas about this, and I would like to share these with you, hoping other people will correct me later. One of the advantages of being scientific about this is to put your hypothesis very clearly with its evidence, so that people know what exactly you are claiming. If you are wrong, if you are proved wrong, somebody else, because you are wrong, can be a little more right. So, during these, today and tomorrow, I am going to suggest Savitri's yoga includes supramentalization as well. And that takes place before the end of books 7, Savitri's yoga. We will talk about it later. So, one of the major differences therefore in Ashwapati's yoga and Savitri's yoga is Savitri undergoes the triple transformation, where Ashwapati undergoes only spiritual and psychic transformation. This is about all, I think, general comments on Savitri's and Ashwapati's yoga. Let us now take up, in the light of these comments, Savitri's yoga. As I said, it begins with book 7. Canto 1 of book 7, if you could look at it, is called the joy of union, the ordeal of the foreknowledge of death, and the heart's grief and pain. I have called it in our earlier sessions as Savitri's Vishada Yoga. You know, in Arjun, in the Gita, you have Arjun's Vishada Yoga. When you are in Vishada, and Vishada comes to you, not you, because you plan for it, nobody plans for Vishada. If at all there is any planning, it is planning to avoid Vishada. We always, Vishada is pain, suffering. Nobody plans for suffering, everybody plans to avoid suffering, so that we don't come under this pressure of suffering. But it comes. Whether you like it or not, we won't go into the reasons why suffering comes to us, but it comes. And like everything, I mean, Mother has made it absolutely clear that once you turn to yoga, everything that comes to you comes from the Divine. Everything. Including Vishada, including suffering. Now when it comes, three solutions are generally available. One, of course, is trying to drown your sorrow by jumping into life, going on a long holiday to Riviera, or Sita travels South Africa, World Cup thrown in. But unfortunately, all these come to an end. The World Cup one day will end. It will end on the 23rd of March. So they will put you back on a plane on the 24th of March and send you back to India. Then when you come home, the Vishada is still there. It's frozen there. It has become larger. The second way of fighting sorrow is, instead of working for 8 hours, working for 16 hours a day. So you don't have time to ask yourself whether you are happy or unhappy. At the end of the 16 hours, you almost collapse in fatigue on your bed. This is another way. But that also doesn't cure or remedy the central problem, which is the pain that has driven you to all these. So the spiritual way to it is to face it boldly, confront it with both hands, and see what you can do with it. It's not easy. It burns your flesh. It dries up your blood. It's a very, very painful process. But since the Vishada was sent to you by the Divine, in this confrontation you must realize you are not alone. The Divine is with at the back of you. And if you are sincerely and honestly face it, there is a spring action, as it were, and your consciousness, at a point in time you are not even aware of, suddenly takes up a jump. The source of pain is still there, nothing has happened to it, but it has lost the capacity to hurt you and to touch you. The pain is still there, but you are on top of it. You have gone above it. So this kind of thing can happen. And in Savitri's case also, Sri Aurobindo describes very beautifully that 1 year that Savitri spends with Satyavan, where every day is a golden day, spent in the company of the one person she loved and married to, and in the sylvan surroundings of the forest verge. She is very happy. She is a princess, used to luxury. But Sri Aurobindo describes, she doesn't despise the labor of the broom and the jar and the filling up of water from the village well, etc. She enjoys everything, because there is that uplift in her heart. In her palace, I don't think she ever had to sweep her own room. But here, there are no servants. Dhimatsena is a blind, exiled hermit. Where will servants come to him? So Savitri had to do everything. So Savitri doesn't mind all these hardships, because she is now living in a dream life with the one man she loved, in her company, in his company. But at night, when she wakes up, middle of the night, suddenly she remembers, my golden book of life has only 365 pages. Today I have lived out page number 245. How many more days are left? So each day she lives out, she comes that much closer to that dreaded date when Satyavan has to die. And Narada has said this, it will never go false. He will die. He is convinced of that. So on the one hand, so she, on one life of her, there is nothing but heaven. Another bank of her life is hell. So this is a river. Her life is like a river that runs through two banks. One of it is heaven, the other is hell. And Sri Aurobindo describes this very, very beautifully. The most dramatic canto in many ways in this whole of Savitri is this particular canto, and showing how Savitri tries to cope with this. Then we come to the second canto, where the real yoga of Savitri begins, and that canto is called The Parable of the Search for the Soul. How Savitri sets on a journey, search for the soul. and it begins in a very dramatic way. And mother has said something about this. Savitri is seated there at night, full of forebodings, full of sad thoughts. Very soon Satyavan is going to be no more. What choices do I have? What do I do? I am a small, helpless mortal, and God of death represents a primal force of nature. How can I fight him? So she's thinking of all this. Suddenly she hears from within a voice which says to her, "Arise, O soul, and vanquish time and death." Some her own inner being, as it were, asks her not to give way to despondency, pessimism, defeatism. Rise. Now is a chance. Your life is going to suddenly take a different turn. This is the crucial moment. Rise, O soul, and vanquish time and death. This is on page 474. Three lines, four lines from the bottom. Line 28. Arise, O soul, and vanquish time and death. Savitri just refuses to move. She says, "My strength is taken from me and given to death. Why should I lift my hands to the shut heavens, or struggle with mute inevitable fate, or hope in vain to uplift an ignorant race who hug their lot and mock the Savior light, and see in mind wisdom's soul tabernacle?" She gives a number of reasons. Man doesn't bother. Fate is too powerful. I am all alone and single. How can I fight? The mother has commented on it. He says, "This is unlike me. This is not me." To say, "Oh, the problems are too much for me. How can I fight them?" Right? If problems are great, you have to rise to a greater height to vanquish the problems. That was the mother's spirit in agenda. At one point he says, "This is not me." This is a dramatic way of Sri Aurobindo presenting the character of Savitri, but that's not me, she says. So, I also pointed out to you places where Savitri is not the mother. Then, there are lines. Ultimately, Savitri begins to feel that she should now listen to the inner command, and says on page 476, line 82, middle of that page, a power within her answered the still voice, "I am thy portion, here charged with thy work. As thou myself seated forever above, speak to my depths, O great and deathless voice, command, for I am here to do thy will." And then come 18 lines of great power, and in a condensed fashion, Sri Aurobindo, in these 18 lines, defines the aim of his yoga and also the discipline to be followed. All these in 18 lines. And 18 lines, 18 is a very significant mystic number. Those of you who have a knowledge of Indian scriptures can rattle off a number of places where 18 is very significant. Gita has 18 chapters, Mahabharata has 18 parvas, and so on and so on and so forth. 18 lines begins with, "The voice replied." We'll read those 18 lines and then we take a break and look at them in some detail. "Remember why thou camest. Find out thy soul. Recover thy hid self. In silence seek God's meaning in thy depths. Then mortal nature change to the divine. Open God's door. Enter into his trance. Cast thought from thee that nimble ape of light. in his tremendous hush, stilling thy brain, his vast truth wake within and know and see, cast from thee sense that veils thy spirit's sight. In the enormous emptiness of thy mind, thou shalt see the Eternal's body in the world, know him in every voice heard by thy soul. In the world's contacts meet his single touch. All things shall fold thee into his embrace, conquer thy heart's throbs. Let thy heart beat in God. Thy nature shall be the engine of his works. Thy voice shall house the mightiness of his world. Then shalt thou harbor my force and conquer death. Well, many of you probably know that there is a little write-up on this, prompted by Kantibai's question to me, and my exposition of these lines was tape-recorded, then printed, and then he distributed about 500 copies. Now, as I said, I don't remember exactly what I said. Let me have a cup of tea and come back and see whether I can see what I said in those pages. So we'll take we were on page 476, where Savitri's own inner being gives her a program, an agenda, which is in 18 lines, as I was saying, and they're beautiful lines. And when we were first studying this part of Savitri, we spent considerable time looking at these lines. Now, it may not be possible for us to do the same thing this time. It's a kind of a rapid review, otherwise we won't get very far. As I said, at one point, an exposition of these lines were available in a book form. As I said, most of it I've forgotten. Kantibai knows about it. If you want, you can ask him to give come in the afternoon and give a talk on these things, because he is the one who published this material. But he also is a very busy man, so he may not be able to do it. So the point I'm trying to make is, these are lines. They are not very difficult lines. They are not obscure lines. Very easy. All that we need is to dwell on those lines and take them to heart and think more and more about them, and the lines will open up. Remember why thou camest. Now, the very first line gives almost the context of Sri Aurobindo's yoga. Why are we here? Most other yogas don't ask this question. They start with the existentialist situation. I am in pain, I am in suffering. I want to get rid of this pain. And whatever helps me to get rid of this pain is good for me. That's my yoga. Life is a painful experience and I want to get out of this painful experience. And the pain is so excruciating, I'm not listening to anybody who says why this pain came. Please, all your philosophy can wait. Get this tooth out. So there is that urgency, but the problem is you are throwing the baby with the bathwater. The pain comes to remind you of some unfinished business here. That's the purpose of this pain. But we get so ruffled, so overpowered by this pain, that we have no patience to ask why are we here and how did this pain come. But I can't go on expanding on this. Sri Aurobindo's yoga says, why are we here? What is the evolutionary context in which we live? From where did we come, and where are we supposed to go? And yogi, the object of yoga is defined in these terms. In terms of humanity's situation now in the evolutionary journey. And his, Sri Aurobindo's analysis is, we are all victims of a particular illness or remedy or illness or weakness called being trapped in the mental consciousness. Mind is a great, meant a great advance from the animal world to the human world. That's where we got trapped, and pain is just to prod you on to move beyond it and not to force you out of this entire evolutionary, you know, this evolutionary journey. There are two ways. One is, I find the journey very painful, so I want to get out of it. The other is, something is pulling me back, pushing me back, holding me back, I want to transcend it. Maybe when I cross this, once again life will be smooth. There are two solutions. Sri Aurobindo's solution is that we should not try to get out of it, but get over the present limitation, which is the mental consciousness. So in this very